By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, from New York, my co-host Sebastian Silva talks to Hersan Zarita of the Credit Strategy and Research Team in Sao Paulo and Semyon Isakov of the Banking Team in Moscow about inflation in Latin America and in Russia and what it means for finance and for banks in particular. Sebastian, welcome back.
Thank you, Danielle. It's good to be back.
Okay, now tell me about inflation. Our listeners want to hear about inflation.
I know, inflation. It's true. It's real. It's actually starting to pick up in parts of the world, believe it or not. Namely, Latin America and Russia. We're going to look at Latin America, and inflation is picking up there for different reasons. Hersan looked at three economies there, and specifically what's driving inflation and how the central banks are responding. And then Semyon, an analyst in Russia, is going to talk about the effect that higher inflation is already having on some of the banks there.
What's the short version? Does Hersan's report raise any alarm bells?
Not yet. His report projects central bank actions and then also some return to normalcy of supply and demand as the world recovers from COVID is all going to help bring inflation back within bounds of central bank targets by 2022.
But it's something Hersan and other analysts at Moody's are watching, right?
Yes, it's definitely a trend we're keeping an eye on.
Thanks, Sebastian. We'll hear more about that in a few minutes. But first, it's Cinco de Mayo, commemorating the Mexican Army's victory over the French at the Battle of Puebla in 1862. And as we turn to Mexico today, we find that the government is still battling the effects of low oil production, and we'll look at what that means for the state-owned oil company Pemex. It's not such good news for banks because it means the government has that much less in resources to support the banks in case of a crisis. I'll be talking to Felipe Carvalho of the banking team in Mexico City about that, and also to Mick Cabella of the banking team in London about a similar trend in Saudi Arabia. Felipe, we'll start with you. Why does Pemex matter so much to the Mexican government, and what does it mean for banks?
Thanks, Danielle. Pemex is by far the largest company in Mexico. It is also a very important symbol for Mexicans. One of the most important crossroads near our Mexico City office is marked by a massive, beautiful Art Deco column that commemorates the nationalization of oil in 1938. It is a great pride for Mexico to know that the oil underneath is of the Mexican people, even if people understand that the company could be doing much better. Our standalone baseline credit assessment of CAA2 for Pemex speaks about those vulnerabilities. As such, Pemex matters to Mexican banks greatly. As most companies that are considered national champions in Latin America, it is not surprising to find Pemex among the largest exposures of Mexican banks. However, because of its vulnerabilities, banks do limit their overall concentrations to Pemex and Pemex-related risks by making sure they not only have direct exposure to the company, but also to specific projects or suppliers, which can serve to insulate the cash flow that will repay those exposures from Pemex itself.
Thanks, Felipe. And with oil production low and oil prices below what's needed for the government to manage its fiscal accounts so that Pemex needs government support, what does that mean for banks?
What the continued difficulties of Pemex mean for banks has to be analyzed from the current administration's focus on undoing what it perceives as a backdoor privatization of the Mexican people's oil in years past, and its fiscal conservatism. What these two aspects mean or have meant for Pemex is underinvestment in exploration and production, but at the same time, very high support for the company over and above other entities in the country. With this in mind, last year, we lowered our government support assessment for Mexican banks. As you may know, in Moody's, government support is an integral part of bank ratings. As such, we no longer assume a very high government support for the largest banks in Mexico. However, Danielle, well, we do continue to incorporate on average, one notch of support for our large rated banks, giving their importance to the country's payment system.
I see. Turning now to Mick, how similar is the story for Saudi Arabian banks in terms of government support?
Thank you, Daniel. We expect that the willingness of the Saudi authorities to provide support to local banks in case of need will remain high. And this assumption reflects the importance of those banks for the domestic financial system. However, the capacity of the Saudi government to support the banks may weaken, as indicated by our negative outlook on the rating of the government of Saudi Arabia. The negative outlook on the government rating reflects the downside risk to Saudi Arabia's fiscal strength due to two main factors. Number one, the severe shock to global oil demand and prices amid the coronavirus pandemic. And number two, the uncertainty regarding the degree to which the government will be able to offset its oil revenue losses and stabilize its debt burden.
Thanks, Mick. And just to be clear, the global economy has stabilized a bit and oil prices have come up quite sharply since the low points of 2020. But you still expect government support to be lower for banks in the near term. So why is that?
Sure. While we expect both the global economy and the Saudi economy to gradually recover in 2021, and while oil prices have recovered somewhat from the low levels of early 2020, those oil prices remain below the pre-2014 levels. Hence, the downside risk to the Saudi government's fiscal strength could lead to a reduction in the government's ability to support the Saudi banks.
Mick, Felipe, thanks very much. Turning now to my co-host Sebastian Silva in New York, who will be speaking with Gersan Zurita of the Credit Strategy and Research Team in Sao Paulo and Semyon Isakov of the Banking Team in Moscow about rising inflation. Sebastian, over to you.
Thanks, Danielle. Gersan, Semyon, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Gersan, inflation, of course, is hugely important in global finance, but you looked at three major economies in Latin America, Brazil, Chile, and Colombia. So my first question is twofold. First, what signs of inflation are you seeing exactly? And second, why did you focus on these three economies?
Sebastian, so as to the first question, we have noted a reflation trend since November of last year that has continued into this year in the region. So we wanted to take a fresh look at the trend, in part because we had said in September of last year in a report on the outlook for interest rates that low inflation would allow central banks to keep interest rates at low or very low levels. And interest rates, obviously, are the key ingredient to finance. So the credit implications for banks, financial companies, insurers, and asset managers differ somewhat, but can be significant. What we concluded in this new report is that although inflation is rising, we can still expect for now that the rise is transitory and the credit implications not that significant. But this is a trend that we will keep watching. As regards the three countries selected for the new report, we did notice a quicker pace of inflation in much of the region, in fact, including Mexico and others. But we wanted to look at the drivers and found that these three countries where the factors have influenced the inflation outlook differ in rather distinct ways.
I see. So digging into it a little more, what would you say is driving the rise in these specific countries? Are there some similar drivers, some overlap, or is it a unique set of circumstances for each country?
I think it's a little bit of everything. In Brazil, inflation has been driven by an increase in basic commodities in local currency. And this has affected not only Brazil, but also other countries in the region and even throughout the whole emerging markets universe. The real, the Brazilian currency, devalued by quite a bit last year. And this effect is being passed through in the economy. So we see food and energy prices rising. Now, in Chile, the main driver has been the extraordinary stimulus given to consumption by allowing workers to withdraw portions of their accumulated pension savings. And this has led to very high demand for items where there have been significant supply constraints. And so that has led to price increases. And in Colombia, inflation has remained well within the central bank's target, but mainly due to very sluggish activity and high unemployment. And it is this last factor common to all countries that led us to the conclusion that this bout of inflation is likely to be transitory. Now, in all countries, the pandemic dynamics will continue to influence consumption. So things like mobility restrictions, in particular, which affect services, will likely moderate inflation elsewhere in the economy. Also, fiscal expansion is beginning to worry some central banks. So in Brazil, we can expect higher rates to contain inflationary pressures. But we expect the peak of the cycle to be at a fraction of the top rate we saw in the previous cycle, nothing even close to 14.25%. And Chile is likely to begin to normalize monetary policy before the end of the year, Colombia as well, sometime after that. Rates in Mexico did not go down as much as in these other countries, mainly because inflation was relatively high, and also because the central bank looks closely at the relationship between the Mexican peso and the US dollar.
I see. So all of this makes me wonder what lies ahead maybe for these countries. If we could split up a short term and maybe a long term. Short term, do you expect inflation to continue rising?
Yeah, we can expect inflation to keep surprising us in the very short term. But as support from governments withdraws, we will likely see lower pressure on goods prices. If pandemic-related restrictions ease significantly, then activity will likely resume, causing prices to rise until supply adjusts sufficiently to meet demand.
And then longer term, maybe when we're living in a post-COVID world or a more normalized world, is inflation here to stay? When does it start to have credit implications for the region?
At present, we don't expect inflation to keep accelerating for long. Rather, we see very high unemployment in all countries. Many workers dropped out of the labor force last year, and this imbalance will take some time to fix itself. Some countries, in fact, like Brazil, were recovering smartly before the pandemic began, but unemployment was still very high from the effects of the 2015 recession. And in Mexico, labor market conditions were already deteriorating before the start of the pandemic. So this will all work to keep inflation expectations well anchored.
Thanks, Ersan. Now, Latin America isn't the only region that's seeing inflation pick up. That's also been the case in Russia, and it's already had some effect on its banks. Semyon is here to talk about that. Semyon, what's been the main credit effect of inflation on the Russian banking system?
Indeed, inflation in Russia also spiked from a record low level of 3% a year ago to almost 6% today. And of course, this has a direct impact on banks. This is because the average yield on bank deposits settled below 5% for some time, meaning real yields are now negative. Unsurprisingly, this made deposits increasingly unattractive as a store of wealth, and people are moving their savings out of term deposits to buy things like residential real estate or invest in market securities. So banks are now losing their deposits.
I see. So banks are losing deposits, which are really important to them. Particularly, these term deposits are very important for the Russian banks. So what now? Is this becoming a serious funding problem?
Well, customer accounts is the primary source of Russian bank funding, and term deposits account for roughly 60% out of that. But the remaining 40% are current accounts. So while term deposits are going down, money generally remains in the banking system, as current account growth is compensating for term deposits declines. But despite that, we're concerned that this is becoming an increasing problem for smaller banks that can't fully offset their ongoing term deposits decreases with current accounts. This is because current accounts are growing mainly with few large technologically advanced banks that are also active in brokerage and mortgage markets. So those small banks have no option other than to start paying much higher interest to preserve deposits. And this, of course, will negatively impact smaller banks' margins.
I see. It seems like deposits going down or the decline in deposits is very important to all the banks, but the large banks are a little better positioned to take advantage of where this money is going to because they have these other types of accounts.
That's correct.
Thanks, Sebastian. I have one last question for Semyon. Semyon, Russian banks have seen negative yields before, right? So why is this time different?
You're right, Daniel. Russian banks already saw negative real yields somewhere in 2015. That time, this was associated with the confidence crisis in Russian assets amid geopolitical tensions and the oil price collapse. So banks were rapidly losing their ruble funding that time, and in order to prevent a deposit run, the only option was to hike interest rewards on deposits. that resulted in much higher funding costs and compressed margins. Today, macro stability is much better with a stronger confidence in the local currency, and we see no run into US dollar deposits, where, by the way, real yields are also negative. So this limits options for bank customers, and as a result, money generally stays in the banking system. Because of this, and generally strong level of banks' liquidity, banks' margin proved to be much more resilient compared to what we saw in 2015, especially among largest banks.
Thanks, Semyon. And Gersan, Felipe, and Mick, thank you all very much for your insights, and Sebastian. And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like to read any of the reports referenced in this podcast, you can find those by clicking on the link for this episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. And please tune in again in 2 weeks' time on Wednesday, May 19th, for the next episode of Focus on Finance.